2018 saw many important cases and issues that will shape False Claims Act enforcement today and in the years to come. In this five-part podcast series, we'll analyze some key developments to help you better be prepared if the government comes calling with tough questions. In this episode, we'll visit with Hogan Lovells partner Gajag Obenna from our Washington, D.C. office and senior associate Emily Lyons from our Denver office as they discuss the Brand and Grandston memos at the one-year mark and the effect they are having on FCA matters.
Hello, everyone. I'm Gajag Obenna.
And I'm Emily Lyons.
Welcome to our podcast today, where we're going to be talking about some of the changes that took place with respect to DOJ enforcement policy, with respect to the False Claims Act, in the wake of several memos that came out starting in late 2017, going into early 2018. And let me start off first by talking a little bit about the enforcement environment that was expected when there was a change in administration from the Obama administration to the Trump administration. There are a lot of questions from False Claims Act practitioners as to whether or not there'd be significant changes. And some of the initial signs indicated that there would not be significant changes. Some of the earliest clues that we got with respect to how the government was going to approach False Claims Act and healthcare fraud enforcement in particular after the change in administration were reflected in the budget documents that were sent up by the Trump administration. And his initial budgets included significant increases in the amount of money that was going to be spent on healthcare fraud enforcement. And that led everybody to conclude that there would probably be more of the same in terms of enforcement activity, or if anything, there'd be increased enforcement activity, especially in light of the recovery numbers that the government likes to tout. They tend to analyze each investment dollar based on how much is returned to the government or how much they're able to recover. And oftentimes they bandy about figures of $5 for every $1 spent or $8 for every $1 spent, depending on the year and the amount of the recovery. So it looked like the Trump administration was going down the path of doubling down on that approach and spending the dollars and trying to continue those efforts and build upon them. Now, notwithstanding those initial indicia that we saw through the increased budget requests from the Trump administration, there have indeed actually been some significant policy developments since those requests went in. And specifically, there have been memoranda that have been issued that could have a significant impact on how DOJ approaches False Claims Act cases in particular, with respect to how they handle a variety of different key policy issues, with respect to how they handle declined cases that are subsequently litigated by relators, and may raise some issues for the government in terms of whether or not they want those cases to proceed or not. And so why don't we go ahead and talk about some of those policy memoranda and the changes kind of reflected in there. And Emily, I was hoping you could start off by walking everybody through the three memos that are really at the core of these enforcement policy changes.
Yep, kind of a trifecta of memos that started in November of 2017. So the first memo is called the Sessions Memo. And like I said, in November of 2017, then Attorney General Jeff Sessions issued a memo designed to limit the number and scope of authority of DOJ guidance documents. So this memo was limited to just DOJ guidance documents, and it says, effective immediately, the department components may not issue guidance documents that purport to create rights or obligations binding on persons or entities outside the executive branch. And then in January of 2018, the Brand memo was issued. And this memo kind of expanded on the Sessions memo. So then Associate Attorney General Rachel Brand issued a public memo extending the guidance policy from the Sessions memo to other agency guidance. And the key part of that memo is these principles should also guide the department litigators in determining the legal relevance of other agency guidance documents in affirmative civil enforcement. So the two memos, the Sessions memo and the Brand memo, are kind of related in that they deal with agency guidance. The Sessions memo being DOJ agency guidance and the Brand memo extending to other agencies. And then the third memo is kind of a different subject, and it's called the Grandston memo, and it was issued in between the Sessions and the Brand memos. It was issued on January 10th, 2018. And Michael Grandston, the author of this memo, he's the director of DOJ's Civil Division of Civil Fraud Section, And he issued what was an internal government memo that was then leaked to the public. And this memo had to do with how the government should consider dismissals of declined QUITOM cases. Deputy Associate Attorney General Stephen Cox in February of 2018 addressed all three of these memos, and he kind of described the desired effect of these policy changes in a nice way. He said that the DOJ policy changes are an effort to avoid any attempts to push the envelope by seeking to regulate through our enforcement efforts. So Cox also explained that monitoring meritless cases is not a good use of department resources, and litigating them is not a good use of judicial resources. So he kind of summed up the three memos in this February statement. But I think that they do, looking at them as a trifecta or as a progression of one another is a helpful way.
And if I could jump in here real quickly, I had conversations with some of my former civil division colleagues, and I know other colleagues of ours here at Hogan Levels also had discussions with civil attorneys. And interestingly, the take that we got from the civil division attorneys or the U.S. Attorney's Office attorneys was that the Brand memo in particular wasn't a huge deal to them. From their perspective, they'd always rooted their cases in violations of statute or violations of regulation. So from their perspective, they just thought this was just codifying in some ways what they had been doing anyways, because the fact that they'd always been basing their investigations on statutory or regulatory violations. So it was interesting when the memos came out, there was much fanfare externally. I know there were a lot of client alerts flying around, including from us. But internally within DOJ, my sense was that a lot of the, especially career attorneys, didn't see these memos as being anything earth-shaking.
And especially considering the knowledge exception that's explicitly in the Brand memo too, that you can always use agency documents. The government can use agency documents to show that the defendant had knowledge of the particular standard at issue.
That's right. I mean, a lot of the attorneys, again, I spoke to who were still in the government, pointed to that carve-out and said that's exactly how we'd been using agency guidance in the past. And so, again, from their perspective, they didn't see this as any kind of earth-shaking or radical change in enforcement policy, notwithstanding what was being said publicly by higher-level DOJ officials in the speeches that we've seen in the wake of the issuance of these memos. But you know, there have been instances in the past where I know for a fact they've relied on agency guidance for the purposes of bringing false claims on cases or claiming that something that a defendant did was false. And in particular, thinking about the cardiac device cases from the early 2000s, where basically the government had a series of investigations and cases that were based on the notion that certain cardiac devices were not covered under the Medicare manual for a period of time, and to the extent to which those devices were billed by hospitals to Medicare, that was a False Claims Act violation. And again, that violation was rooted in the fact that devices were not covered within the context of the Medicare payment manual. And of course, that was agency guidance. That's not regulation. It's not promulgated under the normal notice and comment procedures. And the case was completely rooted in that. Billing for investigational advice was false because, you know, you ran afoul of this Medicare manual. And so despite the fact that I was hearing comments along the lines of this wasn't a big change, we've been rooting our cases in regulations and statutes all along, that wasn't entirely accurate. And I'm sure there are other examples too, you know, where that was the case.
I think you mentioned to me when we were talking about this how the government, at least in the provider cases, can shift the actions to more of a Stark or anti-kickback related violation.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's really how they would characterize it. One other area I think where we saw it in the provider world where guidance documents took a paramount role in terms of being the basis for a claim of falsity in a False Claims Act case was also in the cost reporting cases that were out there back in the early 2000s as well. That being said, DOJ will say, like, look, okay, maybe historically, whether it's in the cost report cases or whether it's in the context of these device cases, there were some cases that were rooted in guidance documents. You know, the vast majority of cases today are rooted, at least in the healthcare context, alleged violations of the anti-kickback statute, off-label marketing, or Stark violations. And so I can see them taking the position that, yeah, you're pointing to the historical cases, but the current enforcement environment, at least within the last 5 to 10 years, really, we've been focusing on statutory and regulatory violations. So this isn't that big a deal. But there is some precedent for them using guidance documents in the past.
Right. And at least, you know, we know that this is going to be in the back of their minds moving forward in terms of coming up with new theories of liability. They might be more cautious in going after cases where relators root their cases in agency guidance.
Yeah, and I think that's a nice transition point to talking a little bit about the Cranston memo, because not only will they not be a little bit more cautious in going there, they might be affirmatively dismissing cases that are really rooted in alleged violations of guidance documents. So let's talk a little bit about the Cranston memo. As you mentioned earlier, the Cranston memo was issued in January of 2018. It was an internal document that was not meant to be made public, but clearly someone leaked it and had to, and presumably it was someone within the government. And if you look at the Cranston memo, really, it talks about the fact that line attorneys need to think about whether cases should be dismissed if they get to the point where they're recommending declinations. And in thinking about whether or not a case needs to be dismissed, the Cranston memo laid out 7 different criteria or factors to consider as line attorneys are deciding whether or not it makes sense to seek dismissal. The first criteria being desire to curb meritless claims. The second being preventing parasitic or opportunistic QI-TAM actions. The third being preventing interference with agency policies and programs. The fourth being controlling litigation brought on behalf of the United States. The fifth being safeguarding classified information and national security interests. The sixth being preserving government resources. And the seventh being addressing egregious procedural errors. And so clearly the Cranston memo contemplates thinking about all these things within the context of whether or not it makes sense to dismiss a case, particularly a case that is declined or already or is about to be declined. But Emily, you know, you took a look at some of the dismissals that took place prior to the Cranston memo. And maybe you can give our listeners a sense of how expansively that dismissal authority was used by DOJ before Cranston and some of the ways in which it was used.
Yeah, and we found a really interesting study conducted back in 2013, but I think it has some relevance here. And this study looked at cases where DOJ invoked Section 3730C2A, which is the section of the False Claims Act that gives the department the ability to dismiss cases, and conducted a sample of cases where 3730C2A was invoked. And it was only used in about 4% of QI-TAM cases. And of the 4%, nearly all of the dismissals were based on the department's determination that a relator's claim was either jurisdictionally barred on because of public disclosure concerns, original source, or first-to-file grounds. So they weren't looking at any of the 7 factors listed in the Cranston memo. There were a couple of cases that concerned national security, but there were not a lot of cases that concerned a judgment on the underlying case merits. So really, what I think this study shows is that DOJ really hasn't been focused on the 7 factors in the Cranston memo previously. So what I think the Cranston memo is telling us is hopefully that's going to change. So we've taken a look throughout 2018 after the issuance of the Cranston memo to see if there's been any changes.
Yeah, and there clearly has been an uptick in dismissals, although a lot of that can be tied to one particular set of investigations that I'll get into in a second. But when we looked back at dismissals by DOJ under the 3730C2A, in 2017, based on our research, it looked like DOJ only filed 3 motions to dismiss QI-TAMs. And in 2018, however, we see that DOJ's filed 16 motions to dismiss based on 3730C2A. Now, 10 of those are connected to cases brought by a relator called the National Healthcare Analysis Group against all drug companies. And these were allegations that related to patient support programs. And so, you know, the large majority of the dismissals in 2018 were tied to that particular set of cases from that relator. However, I think there's a couple of interesting things to note there. One is when we looked back at 3730C2A dismissals historically, not just in 2017, but even before then, it looked like to the extent to which there was a reason articulated by the government, that reason was really based on burden to the government. I'd say there's kind of two buckets of different considerations. If you look at the Granson memo, there's meritless cases, which is one. And I'd say the other six factors I laid out earlier really relate to whether or not this is a burden to the government in some way, or whether or not government interests are implicated or government prerogatives are implicated, but basically burden to the government's the way I would consider like the other six criteria versus merit. And in the past, I mean, if you look at the previous dismissals by DOJ of declined cases, a lot of it was based on this burden to the government reason. I mean, to the extent to which, again, they articulated a reason that's beyond public disclosure or some of the other factors you noted, Emily. But in those cases involving the National Healthcare Analysis Group against the drug companies, interestingly, in connection with those cases that the government dismissed that were brought by the National Healthcare Analysis Group, the government did talk about merit and talked about the value of patient support programs and really made a statement that went directly to the merit or the appropriateness of the defendant's conduct that I think was unusual and unusual in a good way, and hopefully is a sign of things to come with respect to the government in terms of its moving to dismiss cases. Hopefully we will see more dismissals in the wake of the Granson memo, and hopefully we'll see more of those dismissals discuss merit as opposed to simply being about the burden to the government.
And I think some of the six motions to dismiss filed by the government that weren't part of the NHCA cases, those also, the government did cite some merit-based arguments in those cases as well. So just like you said, Gija, hopefully this is kind of a change in how DOJ approaches these dismissals. One thing to consider is how we bring up these arguments to the government. So we've already talked about how historically the government has been more receptive to arguments for dismissal where they concern the government's interests or protecting the government's resources. So I think it makes sense to start thinking about how we start presenting these types of arguments to the government, how we can make the case for the government to file a 3730C2A motion. And in looking at a lot of these dismissals historically, there actually is a circuit split in the standard that the government has to meet under 3730C2A. And the DC Circuit Court of Appeals has held that the government has unfettered right to dismiss a quitam action. So basically, the DC Circuit has said that the government doesn't really have to meet any standard at all. It can file a 3730C2A motion and the court's going to grant it. The Ninth Circuit has taken an opposite approach. The Ninth Circuit requires that the government identify a valid government purpose that is rationally related to dismissal. And that case is the Sequoia Orange standard. So the Second Circuit and the Tenth Circuit follow that standard. So we know what a court would do likely in the DC Circuit, which is that unfettered right standard. And then in the Ninth Circuit, Second Circuit, and Tenth Circuit, they follow this valid government purpose standard. But what I've noticed in looking at all of these cases is that the government is going to say that regardless it meets the Sequoia Orange standard. And a lot of times the courts that aren't in the DC Circuit, the Second, Tenth, or the Ninth, are going to say, you know, it doesn't matter. The government meets the Sequoia Orange standard anyways. So I think in presenting these types of arguments to the government, assuming that defendants think that they have them or our clients think that they have them, assuming that the Sequoia Orange standard is going to apply is the best way to approach this. So building up that valid government purpose, tailoring it to what we know the government already likes, which is the protecting government resources, looking at the government interests, we think that that's a good way to start approaching these conversations by one, assuming that Sequoia Orange applies, and then looking at the valid government purpose in terms of how do you protect the government's resources.
Yeah, I mean, I think practically speaking, the Sequoia Orange standard is pretty low anyways. I mean, a valid government purpose is easily met by the government in a variety of different ways. So it's an easy burden for the government to meet. I think using it as a default makes a ton of sense. You know, at the same time, though, I totally agree that appealing to the government's notion of burden not being something that they want to take on with an ongoing declined QITAM case is something that people want to think about doing. But I do think that the door's been cracked open in these cases in 2018 to really press home the merit point. And combined what DOJ has actually done with, again, that rhetoric that we saw from senior DOJ officials with respect to trying to get rid of meritless cases or the litigation of meritless cases. And there's some opportunities to, I think, push hard on meritless cases to try and get them dismissed. Now, if you asked me before these 10 dismissals came for the NHCA cases, where the emphasis should be, I'd probably tell you, you know, look, talk about merit, but really, you know, you want to have a strong burden argument for the government. But I think with these cases coming out and the commentary that was made in the dismissal motions about the merit, and also some of the other cases, as you point out, in 2018 as well, I think the landscape has shifted. And I do think that now there is an ear within the department with respect to identifying a lack of merit in the case and using that as a basis for declining. And hopefully that trend will continue regardless of what administration is in place a few years from now. So with that being said, why don't we talk a little bit about looking forward here with respect to the Grantston memos and talk about some practical points that may be of value to our listeners. I think the first one is really just to start having discussions early with the government about dismissal. You know, I think if you'd asked me a few years ago, hey, you're counseling a client, would you have discussions about dismissal? At the time, you're pressing the government not to intervene in a case. I would have said, well, I can have those discussions. I just don't know that it's going to be a worthwhile use of time. Because a few years ago, the government wasn't really dismissing a ton of cases, as you pointed out, Emily, with the statistics you went over. And they were generally inclined not to dismiss decline cases, but to let relators go forward. With the Grantston memo, though, coming out, obviously, I think it's valuable to have the discussion of dismissal at the same time you're having a discussion about whether they should intervene or not. You know, because clearly your arguments about declination are going to be rooted in merit. And so there's an opportunity there to talk about why that should be dismissed on the basis of merit. But also, because of certain other court developments, I think the government now has even a bigger burden that they may be facing with respect to discovery, even outside of a case where they've intervened. And let's say it's a decline case. So what am I talking about? Well, in one of our other podcasts, we talked about, you know, the impact of Escobar and ongoing litigation. And clearly, the door has been opened with respect to Escobar on the issue of materiality. Well, in these declined cases, discovery on materiality is going to necessitate getting a lot of discovery of the government. And so there's now even a bigger opportunity for defendants to push that discovery. And it's going to increase the burden on government agencies enormously. So if the issue in a case is marginal with respect to merit, that could be a deciding factor, the fact that you are going to have this additional discovery burden that is being fueled in part by, you know, the materiality language in the Escobar decision. So I think having these discussions early, rooting them in the elements of the Grantston memo are really, really, I think, important.
And in considering putting them in writing, you know, the government's going to have to file, if they're following the Sequoia Orange standard, a motion to dismiss, although the standard might not be high, they're still going to have to draft it. Helping them out and putting these reasons in writing and articulating them for them with specific examples of the types of discovery, for example, that are going to be requested, I think could be helpful in making the case to the government.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, especially about identifying the types of discovery that you may end up doing. I mean, I wouldn't do it necessarily as a threat or anything like that, but, you know, within all reason, it's saying, look, this is what we're going to have to do to establish that XYZ allegation was immaterial. You know, we're going to have to depose these 10 agency officials. We're going to need discovery on these particular topics. We lay it out with specificity, but in a way that's rooted in what you actually would do and not over the top. I think it is very helpful in terms of the decision-making process there regarding whether or not additional litigation is going to be a burden. And I think emphasizing both merit and process in effect, you know, in terms of what would happen post-declination only enhances the arguments that can be made for dismissal under the Grantston memo. Well, thanks, Emily, for the conversation today. Hopefully we've given some practical points here and some things to think about with respect to some of these changes in enforcement policies. If anyone has any further questions, feel free to reach out to us. You can find us, our contact information, on HoganLevels.com. And we also have a more in-depth take on the DOJ enforcement memos and policy changes in our False Claims Act review for 2018. So be sure to check that out as well. I'm Gajah Gabena.
And I'm Emily Lyons.
And thanks for joining us.
Thanks for joining us today. For additional analysis on this topic and others around the FCA, please download our latest publication, False Claims Act 2018 and the Road Ahead, from HoganLevels.com.